Hello and welcome to another episode of the Morning Drive podcast. This episode, I am joined by what can really be described as an industry professional. I would have used the word legend, but if he hears this, it might make him feel uncomfortable. So we'll go with professional. That is Henry Catchpole, writer for Evo Magazine, presenter on Carfection, and also now writes for The Intercooler, which is an online mag. So absolute industry professional, someone that you'll probably have heard of, someone I was very excited to sit down and chat with. So on with the podcast. I've hit record now, and as I say, it's just a general chat. I've not got a hidden agenda. I'm not going to try and sneak out some industry secrets from you. I'm not going to try and get behind some embargoes. I've got no notes. I've got no questions written down. I am just going to treat you like a person.
Good grief.
Hopefully we get to see that you are a person and not this super squeaky clean journalist that we come across all the time. So I'm joined today by Henry Catchpole, and that's it. Away we go.
Henry Catchpole.
That's it.
There we are.
So the one question that I ask everyone is, who are you and what do you do? And that's it. How do we know who you are?
How do you know who I am? Well, you know me from me driving cars and then either writing about them for magazines like Evo or websites or apps, I suppose, called The Intercooler. Mm. And then most people probably know me from doing films on YouTube, I suppose, now, because that's the thing that it's one of the weirdest things, actually. Sort of, I said it before, but I never got into the whole motoring thing to do the presenting on camera thing. It was always about the writing.
Your goal wasn't Top Gear.
No, exactly. Yeah, because
well, the problem is, once you reach the goal of Evo magazine, you kind of run out of things to keep going.
Yeah, one of my best friends at university, he's a monk, actually. He said to me, he's like, what are you going to do now? When as soon as I started Evo, it's like, you've achieved your dream.
Yeah. You know? Well, now what?
22 years old, 23 years old. So, but it's, when you appear in a magazine, it's pretty rare that people recognise you. Mm. But as soon as you put your face out on the internet and films and things, then people do know you more than the cars. Well, they don't just know a name; they know very much a face and a name, which is.
It must be a weird thing to get used to. Like, I'm very much starting in that world a very tiny amount. Like, I'll bump into people that have seen me on social media, or an occasional YouTube video. Mm. And it's a very surreal feeling when people go, I know who you are. We've never met before. And you're like, oh, God, how weird is this?
Yeah.
I was on a drive with Haggerty in the Renault.
Yeah.
And a cyclist pulled up alongside us at a junction and went, you're the Tacona guy. I was like, what the hell? I'm in the middle of nowhere. And this cyclist happened to know. And it must be so surreal to get that more frequently than I ever have. And to be known as that bloke off of Carfection.
Yes, it's... Yes, it's very odd, really, because I suppose I'd never really... You know, it's very nice, because people are generally always, thankfully, very nice about it. And it's I've learnt to try and have at least a question, not ready, because I'm not like I'm walking around everywhere, sort of, you know, with a question, sort of looking at people, thinking, are they going to say something? but just otherwise, I realise fairly quickly that people will sometimes stop you and go, oh, you're that chap off Carfection or Evo, or sometimes they'll go, you're Henry Catchpole.
Yeah.
And then it sort of all grinds to a halt. And you're left standing there looking at each other in this slightly awkward kind of sort of, you know, blind first date sort of situation where sort of nobody knows what to say next.
Because you're like, yes. And they're like, cool.
Now what? And most people haven't thought past that initial sort of, which is absolutely fine. And so I've learned that actually the onus is on me to sort of At least it's easier if you're at an event like over at BIST or something like that.
You can say what car are you in
or where you stay or whatever, but have something just so that at least from the perspective that, you know, I don't want people walking away going,
well,
oh, I met Henry Gainsborough and we didn't really say it. So it's, you want to at least have a sort of.
Yeah, although Henry Gainsborough didn't talk much, did he?
No, which I don't. I'm not going to.
Which is great that you're on a bloody podcast. That bloke that doesn't talk much, let's get him chatting for as long as we can. We've made 4 minutes, so we should hopefully keep going.
Wow.
And that's it. That's as much as we can get out.
Yes, exactly. Short episode.
But no, and I imagine that car events are an interesting one for you because you're within the world where people definitely are going to know who you are.
Yeah.
Because that is your target demographic.
Yes.
And
yeah,
you must constantly be encountering people that go, oh, I saw you do this, this, and this. And you're like, yeah, that was like 7 years ago. Like, how do you remember this specifically? Oh, I watched it on YouTube yesterday. Yes. And you're like, oh, I lived it 7 years ago. Do you ever have any like odd encounters in that kind of world?
I suppose I had a curious one. Well, definitely wasn't at a car event. It was in, we were doing the drive of the new Lotus Emira, and actually we had a couple of problems with the car because it was a pre-prod prototype, so we were trying to fix it, sort of fix something in a car park in Tesco, and I popped in to use the facilities in Tesco and buy some cookies. And I was walking out of the loo, and a chap who was absolutely drenched, and he was looked absolutely knackered in all his cycling gear, and helmets on, so clip-clopping along in cleats. And he said, oh, Henry, sort of. And then we stood in the sort of the corridor outside the Lucent Desert with other people filtering past. And obviously I had something instantly to say to him because he was in cycling gear and found out he was doing massive, long, ridiculous long cycle, kind of as part of some event or other, and he'd seen the Lotus in the car park, and
so I'll hunt him down.
Exactly, yeah. So it was a really nice chat, and I was interested in his. And he actually sent me a message, weeks or later on Instagram, saying, "Oh, I did complete the mammoth ride, and sorry for accosting you instead of in the Tesco." I was like, "No, it's fine." It's
gonna be. Well, at least you were outside of the facilities by then.
Exactly. Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's not the kind of. Right. Oh, I know who you are.
You're like catching each other's eyes. Yeah. Like, no.
Anyway. You've got your penis out. Sorry. Let's carry this later on.
So,
what a way to meet a celebrity, eh?
Well, weirdly, I once met Clive Owen. It was at the Polo. Not that I go to the Polo very often, but it was one of those things invited by a manufacturer to go to it. And I think I said something to him about. Do you remember he did those M5
the BMW
video? Exactly. Exactly. I think they're just brilliant. That E39 M5 with Madonna in it.
Yeah, and the clicking as he lets the auto.
Yeah, correct. I referenced that in one film not that long ago, just because I felt it kind of. I had to do it.
I bring those videos up so often in conversation because they're so good. And that shape M5 is the best M5, and there was a really dark green one at BISTA yesterday.
Oh, nice!
And it had M5 like trade plates on it, so it just said BMW M5. I was like, oh, it might be up for sale. And I was like, I haven't got any money. Why am I even interested? I have a £500 Renault, which is you get. But so how did that encounter go with Clive Owen? I saw you in those BMW videos, and he's like, of everything I've done.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was it, actually. He was, let's put it this way, a social occasion, so he might not have been sober. But then neither was I. So, but yeah, he was actually really happy to chat about them, I think, because it was probably, I'm sure he gets asked by, you know,
so
children
obscure.
Of men or whatever, all sorts of, all the time. But, he was like, oh yeah, they were really good and kind of enjoyed
that. That was kind of like Transporter-esque, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Like, done really differently. And it was a really cool project that I don't think a car manufacturer could really get away with these days.
No, probably.
I guess
probably
you're the closest thing to that kind of advertising for them now.
Yeah, except we're obviously not advertising, so it's kind of...
technically not, but technically not. You are showing off their cars.
Yeah,
to
showing off their cars, yeah, exactly.
Like, BMW can't have an M5 power sliding around a corner on a racetrack in their adverts, but you can do that.
And I can go,
oh look, Henry Kirchpole has power slid this M5 around a corner for us.
Yeah.
Because it was quite early days of YouTube, really, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. You get them on a... I remember them being sent to the Evo offices on a DVD.
Right.
And a nice little metal... I don't think I've got it anymore. Somebody else took it when the office moved, but...
they were very cool.
Yeah, they were really... Or maybe it was a USB stick. Anyway, they didn't back. Just put it up on YouTube, so...
Well, they'd have hit all sorts of censorships and things now.
Probably, yes,
They are on YouTube.
Yes, exactly. I know. Exactly. I don't dig out the DVD ones, so I'm sure you that, but I do watch them a lot.
So, Clive Owen still likes... Because the one that springs to mind, not the BMW video, the film, is Shoot 'Em Up, which is... a bizarre film.
Okay.
Objectively, kills a man with a carrot and tells him to eat his veg. And I'd have asked him about that, and he'd have probably been like, why is that the one that I'm known for? From you absolute nutter. Because he genuinely kills a man with a carrot.
Okay. And
it's such a weird film.
That is very bizarre, yeah. And now I'm thinking cars and carrots.
There's a scene in that film, sorry to interrupt you get off that tangent too much, where he crashes into someone because they won't use their indicators. And he makes this big point about how hard is it to move your hand 3 inches to indicate? And he just runs this guy off the road. So, but yeah, cars and carrots don't tend to go...
No, they don't, unless you're François Delacour.
Why, what did he do?
Because he gave an interview at the end of a stage in a rally. I think he was in an Impreza. And it's something, it's just the weirdest, most surreal interview. The poor stage end interviewer who sort of, opened the door, François, really good time in there. Or you've lost time. I can't remember what it was now even. And he gives this completely surreal answer about a carrot being on his windscreen and then shows them the carrot. And it's just this kind of
this
totally
poor guy's
weird
door. There's a guy with a carrot shouting at him.
Yeah, exactly.
He must have lost a lot of water on that stage through sweat. His brain is stuck on there. Because I saw a video yesterday of... It was at the Canadian Grand Prix where they hit a groundhog.
They actually hit one, did they?
Yeah. Oh, okay. And it's from, above the helmet cam.
Yeah.
And you see it run out and the car goes over it. And they're like, you should probably box so we can check that the splitter's okay. And it's like, how weak are these splitters of a tiny animal? I guess at 150 miles an hour... It's quite a solid object, but it was just really bizarre that, of all the things, that happened. A bit like when the tree fell down at Bathurst and they had to stop the race for about 2 hours so they could clear a tree off the track. a whole tree, full,
straight down
all the way across. But there's some wild things that happen in motorsport, and that's one of the fun parts about motorsport.
Well, I remember back to rallying, it was in, I'm trying to think, it was Ireland, I think it was Ulster. And we used to do the recce because it was part of the British Rally Championship, so you actually got to do 3-pass recce in the days beforehand. And I remember it was this 3-right over a crest sort of between some houses, and it was quite a sort of long crest that sort of continued, but sort of 3 for me was roughly third gear.
Yeah.
So quick enough even in the Swift. And it was one of those ones where just looking at sky pretty much as you went over the top of this, so trying to pick a line to know where to go on this, cornering, cresting, what have you. And there was a telegraph pole, and I thought, okay, and as I came over, that's a pretty good line actually. So I put in the notes, 3-right over crest, aim at pole. And then, whatever it would have been, 2 days later, we came back to that particular stage. Chris, who was sitting next to me, you hear the note, 3-right over crest, pole or whatever. And you come over the crest and it's like, there's no pole there. And there'd been a storm and it had blown down in between the recce and the things. Yeah, then just trying to think, if I was a pole, which I sort of am, I suppose, where would I stand to aim at? And you just had to sort of...
God.
There we go.
Something that would seem like a permanent reference point, really, isn't it? It's not often that telegraph poles aren't there in 2 days.
No, exactly. Yeah.
God.
It's
So how much motorsport have you done then? Obviously some rallying and a Suzuki Swift.
Yeah. Not a huge amount. I did all my racing, all my races weirdly, all 4 of them have been at Brands Hatch. I did some Ginetta racing.
Oh, nice.
Quite early on in my career at Evo in G20s, and so I did a double header. It was the very first weekend of, do you remember A1GP, the Grand Prix of, it wasn't Grand Prix of Nations, but sort of they had a, it was a single-seater series, and they had each country entered a driver, and it was sort of a bit like Formula E,
yeah,
in a way, but with not electric, fairly obviously. Yeah, so. Yeah. But it was the very, it was released to some fanfare, and the first ever race was at Brands Hatch, and I was one of the undercard.
Really?
Races, yes.
Who were you racing against?
Quite a big field, pretty much all of which was ahead of me. So it was, including...
it's quite a daunting challenge, really, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was kind of... So I managed to not qualify last, which was quite an achievement, given that I'd never driven the car other than in practice. I'm not sure I fitted particularly well either. I borrowed a race suit. And then... Yeah, I spun going down through Paddock Hill Bend on, I think, the second lap, having made a relatively good start. So it was all going well, and then it wasn't. So I then sort of potted around and I finished, but that was about it. And then the second race on the Sunday, it would have been, we were all lined up waiting to go out to the grid, sitting there on our slick tyres, or dry weather tyres anyway, and we just saw the heavens open. So we were sitting there, and there was no time to go and... you know, swap tyres or anything like that. So it was a wet race on slick tyres.
Just driving on ice, basically.
Yeah, and it was just a matter of survival. I knew that if I could just keep it on the island, then I'd actually finish it. And I finished, you know, halfway down the field or something just by keeping it.
Yeah, which is Saab's original method of winning all those rallies and the endurance races. They just didn't stop, so therefore they kind of won. Yeah. Like, I think they won, like, the Dakar, possibly the Millimiglia, however it's pronounced, and I think it was another long stint one, and it was literally just because they didn't break down. They were the only cars to just go through the whole thing, so their time averaged higher than the others.
Yeah.
And it's definitely a tortoise and hare scenario that if you just finish,
yes,
and half the pack don't, you by default have won by half.
But yeah, so then did, and that was on the full Grand Prix circuit as well, which was amazing. And I was Alistair McRae's chauffeur for the weekend as well. So,
pretty interesting event then.
Yeah.
So you were racing and having to chauffeur someone.
Well, yeah, because I was in one guest car. I was in the Gran Turismo liveried, supported car, guest car. And then there was a Dunlop liveried, sort of black and yellow guest car as well. And Alistair McRae was in that one at the... other end of the field, needless to say, particularly in the race that was in the wet on slicks.
Well, if anyone's going to be able to pilot a car with no traction,
well, exactly,
it's one of the McRae's, isn't it?
Yeah, and but because we were both been put up in the same hotel for that weekend, and Martin Pfaff said, "Oh, would you mind because he's flown in." Perhaps you could give him a lift to the hotel.
To ferry him around.
Yeah, exactly.
Did he give you any driving critiques while you were going?
No, he was really... I mean, I was nervous as anything, I think, and probably more nervous about that than actually racing.
Yeah.
Because...
Well, it's one-to-one in a car.
Yeah, exactly. And I was, you know, a relatively personal person and could have, you know, chatted away to him, but he was exactly what you think a McRae is going to be, in terms of he was constantly sort of larking around, and instantly as well clocked the Mark 5 GTI. Remember the big those fantastic alloy wheels and monster wheels, weren't they?
They were like plates with five circles.
Exactly, particularly had the 19s rather than the 18s, I think it was.
It's a mad size wheel for a Golf.
Yeah.
19s.
It was, I think that's right, wasn't it? Was it 18s instead of 17s?
I think it was 18s.
I think it was.
My Toyota's got 18s, and they fill those arches pretty consistently.
Yeah, I'm just so used to only having 20s now. Let's go with 18s. But they were big and eminently curbable.
Yeah.
And he looked at them and he was like, a bit of shame to curb them, wouldn't it? And then he'd sit there and we'd be going along an orbit of road and he'd get quite high curbs over it, and he'd reach across and just just juke the wind. I'm sitting there thinking, he's like, nobody believe you. If you go to the office and say, Alistair McRae curbed my watch out, nobody's going to
Who's going to believe that story?
So, yeah, so just pre-dash to and from the circuit, at least once on every journey to and from there, you just go, oh, that was close, wasn't it?
You must have been driving so tense, just constantly in like preparation to fight against him doing that.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So,
I believe you, Henry.
Exactly. I know, like, thankfully, no wheels were curbs.
Was that your car or was that a
Loma? That was an Evo long-termer.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah.
Because I've heard stories of more interesting events happening in loan cars. Not necessarily you in loan cars, but have you had any of these interesting events?
Any of these interesting... yes, I've had... Well, I suppose... The most interesting one was even before my career started. It could have ended the whole motoring journalism thing before it ever began. Because I crashed a Mitsubishi Evo 7 Extreme up at Bruntingthorpe.
Right.
And that was an auto car. It was Chris Chilton, who was working in auto car. It was his long-termer at the time. And it was part of their 0-100 test. And I'd been in the office all week when I was there on work experience. I hadn't really done anything other than write a couple of 60-word nibs or whatever.
Yeah,
that's news in brief.
Thank you for clarifying that. Right, yeah, I just assumed it was just a thing that you called.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I hadn't really done anything at all. And then Chris Chilton said, oh, do you want to come along to Bruntingthorpe and help with this test? And we were driving out, we filled the car up the fuel. And he said, as he got back in the car, he said, oh, if you need to fill this up later. And I didn't really hear the rest of it because I was like, does this mean I'm going to drive this thing? And I was, I had my Mini Cooper was the fastest thing I'd driven up to that point. Anyway, he went and picked up a Digitec Mercedes of some sort from Stoke Poges, I think, and then I drove the Evo the rest of the way up to Bruntingthorpe with the speedo was wildly overreading, so it was sitting there and I was following Chris and it was saying I was doing best part of 100 miles an hour and I wasn't, but trying to convince myself that I wasn't going to get caught and banned and whatever else can have been this sort of this. That was
that his attempt at cheating at the 0-100 to naught? Because he got to 0-100 a lot quicker.
Yeah, exactly. No, thankfully, we always used proper timing equipment. It's amazing how far out some speedos are. And I drove this thing so cautiously. Like, it just felt like every time it came on boost, this thing just it was completely uncontrollable. So got it there safely, parked up near the entrance gate, all done, went off, sat next to Chris, and he was driving sideways all over the place in this Mercedes and various other things, and I actually said to him at one point, where do you learn to drive like this? Do you have tuition? And he's like, oh, well, not really, but we have it's places like this are brilliant because there's nothing to hit.
Is there?
We all had to go and ferry the cars from one side to the other of the airfield, and I jumped back in the Mitsubishi again just because I thought it was knew what I was doing by this point. And again, I remember driving very sensibly, thinking there's a bit of standing water here, don't daft, get around there. And there was one big left-hander sort of onto the back straight, as it were, and I was like, come on, Henry, don't be a complete this is you meant to, so at least see what we're gonna. And it just crests slightly and it just started to understeer a bit, and I lifted off, and
which is what you would expect,
it's kind of sort of what you'd expect to do, but Evo's those, like, it just I was backwards before I knew what had happened, which I subsequently discovered was actually pretty much what they were kind of, and obviously if I'd known now, you think, well, it's an Evo, so you just stay on the throttle and you just drive through the bit of understeer and it'll be absolutely fine. But obviously I had no idea about any of that kind of stuff, so I just backed off, not trying to do anything heroic,
and then it snaps at you,
round we went, and it was when we hit the grass, that sort of, I'm watching, you just said the Canadian Grand Prix, and poor old Yuki Tsunoda going straight on, sort of, he just you're not slowing down once you hit wet grass.
Yeah, it's and, so little friction on it.
Yeah, and I went, so I went into the trees, and I was, because it's just the nature of the place, to you're going quickly.
Yeah.
Even if you're not being totally stupid, you're going quickly, and yeah, I went in. I remember sort of kind of coming to slightly and looking, was facing into the woods, and the alarm was going off, and I should stop that, and then tried to start it. And then the alarm went off again. I said, oh, no, I need to do this. And then as I was trying to start again, I looked across and realised there was a massive great V in the passenger side of the car.
So you'd hit the tree sideways?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was very lucky, because if it had been
the other way
my
around.
Side, then, yeah, well, it would have been
you wouldn't have been
a lot worse.
Trying to turn it back on very quickly, would you?
No, no. That car stayed there for some time, though. And people would...
Did it have a big yellow police aware stick running in front of it?
Yeah, it's going to... So they had to, yeah, various people tried to sort of... It was quite funny to try and drive. It would drive, apparently.
I guess the...
But it just crabbed and kind of...
Yeah, the bend was, is in the middle, but the wheels yeah. are all still connected.
Yeah, it's like a Renault 4. The wheelbase was shorter on one side than the other.
It just went round corners really quickly if you're going left.
It's probably still quicker than a Renault 4.
As a Renault 5 driver, it will definitely still be quicker than a Renault 4.
But yeah, that was... As you can imagine, they weren't particularly happy with me.
And, wow. I hope their first sentiment was, are you okay?
Yeah. To be fair, Chris was absolutely brilliant. He was, you know, it was, it caused, I think, quite a few problems, because I'm not sure how much I was insured actually right. doing it. And it had all been a bit kind of, you know, I'll check the keys, it's fine, and sort of this, that, and the other. And
what, so this was probably early 2000s?
Yeah.
Kind of so. A little bit before all the current strictness of regulations
yes,
that we have.
Yeah.
It's not like you were going to end up on YouTube in the afternoon or anything like that. And there's no Instagram stories of, oh, look what's happened, and then all this evidence of what's going on.
Exactly. So
it's a little bit less stringent.
Yeah, and it all kind of calmed down a little bit during the... Peter Robinson was there, the famous motoring journalist, who also now writes for The Intercooler.
Oh, nice. Fact.
But and he was... Yeah, by the end of the day, he was recounting sort of, you know, he crashed a Lamborghini Diablo and they put it on the cover and best-selling issue ever and all that sort of thing. So it did.
It's one of those things where as soon as that initial chaos has kind of calmed, and if you're in an industry where people have all done this and it's almost like a rite of passage, I imagine there's a little bit of a camaraderie around it where it, as you say, it all kind of comes out the woodwork after the tears have been shed. And you go, well, I did this and I did this. And the closest I've ever had to that is I borrowed a company that make these mid-engined three-seated sports cars in Cambridge, and they've made two of them so far. And I borrowed one to go and do some press shots for them. This whole scenario went completely like off the rails very quickly within the space of about 3 days. But it started off really positively. And I borrowed this car, and my other half... We went to take it back. It was all down like the country lanes through Cambridge to where they build them. And she kept pulling away from me. And I'm like in this central seated like thing that there's only two of them that exist. And it's got a 1JZ turbo Toyota engine in the back that just wants to spool up constantly. And you go down a country lane and it's about 6 foot wide. And then we got there and she's like, well, you didn't go very quickly, did you? I was like, there's only two of these things. I've never driven a central seated car before. I was like, tell you what, you go and jump in it and see how quickly you want to go. So, well, normally you're really quick. I was like, I'm not crashing someone else's car.
Yeah.
Because that would have just been an absolute terrifying nightmare.
Yes.
Fortunately, the next time I drove it, it broke down. I didn't have to drive it again. I was like, there's your car, not my problem anymore. So my understanding of your journey into car journalism is... Uni, work experience at Autocar. Did you then work for Autocar and then Evo, or how did that all come about?
No, so I did, university, I also entered a couple of sort of young motoring writer competitions.
Right.
Which was good experience, and just sort of it gives you, makes you think, makes you really concentrate on writing.
Which is the biggest challenge, really.
Yeah. And then... And I think I got highly commended in one of them or something like that. So rinse that for all it was worth in terms of trying to leverage access and work experience. And then work experience at Evo whilst I was at university for a week. Then the following year, it was work experience at Autocar, crashed the car. And then, yeah, graduated, thought about joining the army, decided not to. And thought, well, I'll give this motoring journalism thing a crack, because I didn't have a gap year before university. So I thought, well, perhaps I could kind of give myself at least 6 months leeway, sort of, you know, do odd jobs and see what I could, see if I could make the motoring journalism thing work. And I dropped into the Evo offices and handed them my CV and portfolio stuff I'd written, because I'd sort of made myself motoring editor of the university newspaper, the student rag, the Saint. Not that they needed a motoring correspondent, but
I'm guessing you went to uni around here then, if it was called the Saint.
No, it was. I went to St Andrews up in Scotland.
Oh, so, right, okay. Because there's St Andrews Hospital in Northampton as well, and the Northampton rugby team is called. Because we've just moved to Northamptonshire, and we keep seeing they look like little basketball players with halos, and I think they're rugby players with halos.
Yeah,
and we're like, I've not seen these before. And there's a Range Rover up the road that's got N Saints as the number plate.
Yeah.
And it's been puzzling me and puzzling me. And then the other day I came across the rugby team is called the Saints.
It's called the Saints, yeah.
I was like, it finally all makes sense. These weird little like haloed rugby players. But they're like proper metal badges on the back of people's cars.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
It's really like really thrown me off, because I've never seen it for any other sporting team or anything.
It'd be great if the manager or head coach or whatever kind of drove around in a P1800 Volvo, wouldn't it? So, yeah, maybe it'd be too niche for some people. But
so uni up in Scotland then?
So university up in Scotland, yep. So which meant I could blag my way in as a journalist to go and watch races at Knockhill and stuff like that.
Did you get any trips over onto the West Coast?
I did, yeah, because we used to. So the way St Andrews worked was it was we get 4 years at university up in Scotland for the start, which is great. But you have 3 terms and 2 semesters.
Right.
So there was this weird thing. So you'd come back after Christmas and do exams, and then there would be a sort of a 2 week gap, or week and a half or whatever, depending on where your exams fell, before the next semester started. So there was a sort of gap within a term.
Yeah. Almost like a half term in school.
It kind of, yeah. So it always fell, I think, in sort of end of January, February sort of time. When, of course, nobody really wants to go to the West Coast or, you know, go on holiday kind of generally in the UK. So you could rent pretty much a choice of places. You certainly rent somewhere within student budget for, you know, 8 of you or whatever to go and all pile in.
Airbnb before Airbnb.
Yeah, so we had an amazing holiday for a week up on Skye, just above the Talisker Distillery.
Very nice.
Midwinter. It was an old school. And so there was a sort of games room next door, and, you know, stoke the fire up and stuff. And I remember driving the Mini. That was my first experience of the West Coast in my little red Mini with a white roof.
Well, that's a really good car to experience those roads in, though, because it's one of those where you kind of have to keep your foot in to keep your momentum.
Yeah.
And those roads are brilliant for momentum cars. I did the North Coast 500 in the 86 before it was modified and ruined, effectively, according to a friend of mine. And there's myself and a friend who also had an 86. So we had two identical cars, which makes for a lot of fun, because it then becomes a driver comparison, not a car comparison. And we did a similar thing where it was like we stayed in little lodges or B&Bs and stuff for as minimal amount of money as we could, and just absolutely loved every second of driving, because it was such good, wide, like B roads effectively, but it's quiet enough that you don't have to constantly be looking for gaps to pass other cars or things like that. We had this little like cat and mouse with a 70s Volkswagen camper van. So we'd catch them and absolutely blitz off, and then we'd stop at a nice scenic spot for a photo, and then we'd hear a little toot and a wave as they came past. And about half an hour later we'd catch them again, and we must have done that for about 200 miles across 2 days, just constantly back and forth to this lovely little camper. But I imagine a Mini's probably up there in one of the most fun cars that you could do it in, for the pure amount of, right, I've got to chuck it in here and grit your teeth and hold on to it.
Yeah, it was just, it was brilliant. I loved it. Lovely little gearbox in it, and it was on the smallest wheels you could get.
With the biggest tyres?
Exactly. So it was, I loved that. that car and did a lot of miles in it. And
they're great little things, though.
Yeah, again, I just remember it was Optimax at the time, but sort of, you know, if I'd earned enough in working in the bar and the bar theatre or wherever it was, you know, bung a tenner of Optimax in there, which can get you a lot further than it would these days.
Yeah, for sure. I think a tenner will get me to the end of the road.
And there were some really good roads in Fife that I could go out and have a quick blast around in the middle.
Those are the moments where you almost learn how to, not necessarily drive, but you learn how to feel a car and feel a road, and a small, simple car with not a lot of power leads to a lot more kind of development as a driver.
And everything's relative, because at the time it felt like a really quick car. So
yeah.
Sort of I had no real experience of anything. I used to grow up driving old MGs occasionally, or passengering an old MG. So the Mini felt
really quick.
Yeah.
See, I was spoiled because my dad had a Porsche Turbo.
Oh, there you go. You see,
okay. So you lose all sense of speed when you've gone from arguably one of the quickest cars at the time, aside from your like hypercar level stuff.
Yeah.
There's not many other cars passing around the 200 mark. Mm. And because of my dad's any driver insurance policy, I was his pub taxi.
Ooh.
And so at 18, it was, oh, can you pick us up? I'll bring the Porsche. It's like, okay, well, I've got a half hour to kill. What should we do? And going from that to a 998cc Mini, it was a real kind of, right, we have to learn how to drive without any power.
Yeah.
And hopefully keep your foot in. And well, fortunately, they're like a go-kart. But I remember the first time I drove that on my own. I pulled onto a slip road, booted it. I'd never driven a car with a turbo, never mind two. And by the time I could pull my head back down, I was at 130. And I was like, oh, crap. I don't know. I'm going to die. Someone's going to see me. I'm going to crash. I'm going to break my dad's car. And then the first time the back end ever kicked out was like almost 10 years later. In Spain, on the south coast, we took it down there. My dad and my stepmom got married out there, like going around a roundabout, and it was a little bit slippery.
Yeah,
booted it at the wrong time and absolutely shit myself, which is what happens when you don't know how to drive a powerful car.
Yes,
So from uni, bit of a gap, and
yeah, not too much of a gap actually, because I graduated and then I was going climbing in the Peak District with my cousin and. Dropped into Evo's offices, and it was just a lot of it was. It's one of those situations where you really do make your own luck, because I bothered to divert off and go and drop into them.
Yeah.
But I was very lucky that it just so happened the whole sort of sale with Dennis Publishing had taken place, which obviously I didn't know about or have a clue about. But it meant that Richard Meaden was going freelance, and Jethro was sort of. Moving up in the world, because he'd been there for 4 years, I suppose, at that point. So it was all just shifting around and changing. There was this definite sort
some
of
gaps
gap
became...
for somebody to make the tea and coffee at the bottom end of it all to kind of.
Which is wild how that's how it all starts back in the day, isn't it?
Yeah,
someone to make the tea and coffee, and then they get a chance to write little bits, and then that grows.
Yeah, and that was, I did Peter Tomlin, said, well, come and do a work experience for a month, which. Was way more than I was expecting, and I knew that if they wanted somebody for a month, then it was
probably definitely, a shoo-in
there was a job there available, so it was up to me not to screw it up. And it's like so many things you hear about, sort of people say, oh, you be about being a people person. You think, well, how on earth you drive cars for a living and kind of just sitting on your own, how you need to be a people person? But in so many jobs, it was trying not to just be totally overawed by the situation that I was in, because sitting there with these people, they're my absolute heroes. This is absolute dream come true, and I wanted to work there. It was my dream job, as we said earlier, and I still can't quite. At times, when I think back to it. It's sort of kind of gives me goosebumps. Not the I almost didn't care about the. Driving of the car just to sit in the passenger seat of things, or see things turn up in the car park and
be around those people,
get to hear the stories, or be even vaguely involved in sort of planning the odd feature or things like that, was just absolutely
that's such a dream
brilliant.
Job though, isn't it?
Yeah and I very quickly realized that you think, right, well, how can I how can I be useful? So proofreading is one definitely, because when you're sitting there on deadline and being good enough to pick up on things or question things, not everything, but just sort of know when, think, right, well, is that a typo or is it,
yeah,
is that spec actually right? Then as I say, make tea and coffee, because what do people want when it's late at night on a Friday? Yeah. Everybody, so you stand up and say, "Who likes tea or coffee?"
Yeah,
and I didn't drink tea or coffee at the time.
Well, you're drinking water now.
I'm drinking water now. Exactly. I drink. I still don't drink tea really, but
because you turned down the offer of a coffee. I have a proper coffee machine.
I know. I've had two today already, though.
Right. So okay. Kind of,
if you don't want me talking at 5 million miles an hour, then that's, I figured, okay, it was probably best.
I have that tolerance
to limit the caffeine just a little bit. I've had my own, had my caffeine for today. But
I'm not offended, I promise. It took me 3 months to get that coffee machine. DeLonghi broke, my DeLonghi one broke, and then they failed to collect it for 3 months.
Oh.
And eventually I badgered them enough that they just sent me another one. Like, just leave us alone, please.
Go away. So I made lots of tea and coffee and washed lots of cars and did all that. And
I mean, there's worse ways to make a living, I suppose.
Absolutely, yeah. It was, and then they, after about 3 months, caved in and made me staff writer. Or asked, I think Peter Tomlin actually asked me what I wanted my job title to be. Said, have a
what
think
job
about,
do you want? You're like, oh, editor,
yeah,
exactly, please.
Yeah, he said, you can have a think about the job title. And I instantly said staff writer, because I knew that's what Jethro had been and what it was. That was the role.
The
that's what I was aiming for, was staff writer at Evo magazine. I hadn't thought beyond that in my life, sort of thing. So,
well, funnily enough, I was chatting to a lady who works for the publishing company behind Magneto.
Okay, yeah.
I was down at the Savile Row thing, which was on my birthday, funny enough.
Yeah.
And she was very kind enough to indulge me in some conversation as a complete stranger. Just wandered over and went, "You work for the publishing company. I'd like to talk to you, please." she was very polite considering the circumstances. And she'd said a similar thing, that it was like the people that write, they go into that industry to be creative and to write. They don't expect to be then managing people or managing staff or having to make decisions based on performance and things like that. And it becomes you find that you get some very good writers and you get some very good managers, and those two people aren't normally within the same body. And it's probably quite rare that you find someone that is a very good creative writer that has good creative vision and direction, but is also very kind of office politically sound, because they inherently aren't two connected pieces.
No.
It's probably quite few and far between where you get someone that's inept at both without sacrificing either.
And you have to be sort of, I think it's one of these curious things, it is you're working with photographers or videographers now, obviously, in my case a lot of the time. And that's quite you're usually in a relatively sort of slightly stressful or high pressure situation a lot of the time, particularly if you've got not a lot of time to get the footage or whatever. And
a million pound supercar that needs to go somewhere else the next day.
Exactly. And you're trying to find a road that's actually hasn't got roadworks on it, or the track that's going to let you do more than two laps or whatever it is. So you have to, it's why I really appreciate the job that they do, and you have to know when to be helpful, when to step back, what they're going to want you to get involved in, all these things. It's just sort of, and so many jobs are people, much more people orientated than you ever think, aren't they? I think
100%. Like some of the different bit, like I've worked in sales, which is obviously 100% people orientated, and I've worked in, like, I run a warehouse. And it's surprising how much engagement you have to have with other people to make anything work.
Yeah.
Like a colleague of mine, English isn't his first language. And the way he interacts with, say, Volkswagen, when we have a van that needs sorting, he's always like, "Oh, they're really crap there. They never get anything sorted." And I'm like, "Well, let me talk to them." And I've talked to them with the British sensibilities and
with my ability to kind of sweet talk and all that kind of stuff. And I'm always like, oh, it's fine, it's all sorted. He's like, how do you do that? I'm like, you kind of have to know what they want out of the situation and you try and explain it to him. He's like, I haven't got time for that, I just need the van fixing. I was like, well, then you're going to hit a lot more roadblocks.
Yeah.
But you don't expect to have to think about those things when you go, this is a warehouse, there's all this stock that needs to go from here to there.
Mm.
You don't think, I've got to sweet talk the girl at Volkswagen as part of that job.
No.
And I know, I can't remember, either a podcast or a YouTube video or something, where they were talking about, can you remember the Chris Harris on Cars with the P1
mm-hmm.
at, is it Yas Marina?
Yes, yeah.
And it was, I think it was either one of the videographers or the photographer that was there. And they were saying, like, one of the best things about working with him was his ability to go, right, what shot are you aiming for? Where do we need the car? Where do we need it positioned? Like, what angle do you need the wheel?
Mm.
And just getting kind of in the mindset with the people making the shots and going, right, what do you need from me as a tool? Rather than, I'm this personality, I'm big dick on set kind of thing. It's like, no, I'm facilitating having that thing in that space, looking how we need it to look. And I think having an understanding of that really helps, especially for the likes of the videos that you guys are making,
yeah.
where it's like, right, we're a team and we need to create this visually. It's let's leave the egos at the door and work on building this project.
Yeah.
And as I am very new into behind the scenes in the car world, it's really interesting the more that you get involved in these sort of things. Because you find so much about how stuff comes together you would have no idea of if you didn't have in some way like engage with it. Like I was up at the Haggerty Hill Climb at Shelsley.
Oh, yes.
And I bumped into one of your guys.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, Car Fiction was up there.
Yeah, I can't remember his name. I remember it was in a bloody Mitsubishi Shogun or a Pajero or something like that. Because he was telling us about his family's restaurant that wasn't that far away.
Mm.
Oh, I can't remember his name for the life of me. I'm really sorry if he hears this that I've forgotten his name. I can remember cars or dogs, just never people's names. But it was really, really interesting watching those guys work and all the different ways that they were lining up shots and what they were engaging with and where they were positioning themselves. And the very, very mediocre, tiny amounts of video stuff that I attempt to do, the more that you play around with it, the more that you learn how to aim for the different kind of perspectives and the different, oh, it's probably going to come from that angle and all that sort of stuff. And how you build like a storyline in your head as you're taking shots.
Yes.
And you get that, oh, this could lead into this, which could lead into this. And it's one of the fun parts about being creative in the industry, really.
Yes.
And I imagine you find a lot of that with your writing. Different things flow into different places, or do you just go, right, I want to tell this story, and you get typing away and see how it goes?
No, I have to have a... I have to. It's much nicer if you've got a... something in your head in terms of the flow of it, and you know where it's roughly going to go. Doesn't always happen like that, but I think it's probably helped me as well in terms of making the videos, because it's
almost like storyboarding.
You storyboard in your head and have a sort of an idea for where it's all going to. Or at least have an idea of where it's going to start. And beginning in the middle, I'm not very good at ends, but they usually get made up.
Well, that's always the challenge, but it's finding the right point to stop, isn't it?
Yeah. And of course, I've said it before, but I don't prejudge cars, so I'm not going into it with a conclusion in mind, because that would be...
unfair, really.
Yeah, it would be unfair, and it's... even if you turn out to be right, that's fine, but... you don't want to...
you have that confirmation bias
if
you have
those preconceptions. And it still might not be the thing you thought was going to be the most important thing might not turn out to be, and so you don't want... you end up missing out, giving weight to something else that's...
that's an interesting...
more crucial, so... it's...
So do you... because obviously writing is the thing that you've spent most of your working career doing...
Mm.
When you sit down to do a piece, do you effectively go, right, I want to do this, 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 and this, and then you fill that space in between those points? Or do you go, right, I'm going to write my opening, and then I'm going to figure out how that will flow into something else? Like, do you have segments kind of in your head? as part of a plan. This is someone whose only piece of writing you very kindly looked at ended up on Evo's site. That's it. I've ended my writing career at one.
It's much easier to sit there and be critical of other people's writing. I'm quite big on the opening for something. That's where I like to have a good intro that kind of grabs people's attention or comes from a slightly different angle.
So it's not just a back in 1967.
Yeah, which works sometimes. You're just going to find and it might lead into something else. But yeah, it's and I'll know, you'll know from the word count will inform a certain amount of it. So if I've got 3,000 words to write, well, you can be a bit more relaxed and you know you've got time to be a bit more florid about, you know, the way the Copper Beach looks in the sunlight and the evening or whatever it is.
Throw a few more similes in.
Exactly,
there.
Yeah. Whereas if you only got 700 words and you've got a driven of a new car to do, well, actually there's not a lot of room. Yeah, you might have a sentence for your intro and then you're straight into giving essentially the information that people want to know. Because as you're saying, it's not just the people that you work with or you can see that you're working with, it's that whole massive unseen audience out there, and you've got to have, I don't know my audience other than in I'd hate
the
to
YouTube
judge them
comments.
From exactly YouTube comments or the YouTube algorithm that tells me that the average person is whatever, but you so I don't think of sort of an average person that I'm writing for. I think because I still find it odd that if I thought about it too much, I probably would walk away and just hide
this.
In the corner and shake or something like that. But it's you have to have your audience in mind fairly. Obviously, from a point of view now that I'm freelance, am I writing for Evo and that particular audience where there's a certain amount of assumed knowledge perhaps with that audience as opposed to somewhere else where...
maybe like Top Gear Magazine hasn't got quite as an in-depth knowledge because the average kind of passing car enthusiast might engage with that a little bit more as it's a little bit less kind of specific.
Yeah, exactly. I used to have to write for Auto Express occasionally sort of when I was at Evo because they were sister magazines through the publishing house, and there might be only room for one person on the launch in the latter days, so you'd write for both of them, but you'd write
two
completely different articles, and the things you'd mention in each one were some of those crossover, but you'd talk about it in different ways.
Well, the last thing that one magazine wants is to read their article in the sister magazine as well. You use that one over there. So
exactly.
I'm only one guy. I'm really sorry. So, how did you go from writing in magazines to Carfection then? How did that come about?
So with Evo, I started doing the film stuff at Evo,
right?
Which was something that I initially really didn't want to do, because like
you
kind of said before,
it
was kind of, well, no, I wasn't forced into it. And plenty of guys at Evo didn't really, or dabble, but then haven't really gone on to do a great deal. John Barker doesn't really do any film stuff, and Richard Meaden doesn't do a great deal these days, which is a shame really, because he's obviously phenomenally talented. I felt like I sort of felt like I had to, I think,
right?
Because I thought that this was at a time when it's been proved otherwise now, as I said, but it felt like magazines were going to be superseded by the iPad. Because when that came out, everybody was predicting that
was all digital media, and that's all that was going to happen.
Yeah, paper magazines, they're not going to be here. So I was like, right, well, if I want a career, then I probably should look at this video thing.
I think that's how Chris Harris on Cars happened as well, isn't it?
Probably is, yeah.
Just this, right, we've got to be digitally connected.
And so I started doing it there, and it was really when Sam Riley came on board at Evo, and he and I hit it off straight away in terms of, like, I had this idea of the sort of, if I'm going to do it, this is what I want to make. And I used to, you watch the skiing videos or mountain bike videos at the time, and they all seemed to be really all of them, but a lot of them are really nicely produced and beautiful and show the landscape. And I was just saying, car videos weren't really doing a lot of that at the time.
They weren't as cinematic in that regard.
And I didn't really understand why they shouldn't be.
Here is underneath the bonnet. Here is inside the car. Here is the back. Here is the front. Here is the side.
Exactly. They were, you know, relatively prosaic, and that's fine, but Evo wasn't that sort of magazine.
Yeah.
And I felt if we were going to produce content, then it ought to reflect the magazine. And if you have you imagine opening up Evo and you have that lovely picture spread or that lovely opening spread of a whatever,
something image. In the Welsh countryside,
exactly. Yeah. Yes, and it puts you both in the car but also in the place.
Yeah,
and that's what I wanted the films to do, and it's what Sam wanted to do as well. So we were kind of went above and beyond, sort of, I suppose, to try and do that, because we wanted to make stuff that we were really proud of, and that's where we...
Well, you're telling stories is what you do in those. It's not just a, here is the new M5, it has 8 million horsepower and it goes this quickly. It's a car in the scenery. You get almost like a more emotional connection to it, and it really showcases the passion that comes along with the cars, rather than just, it will go this quickly and it looks like this and it costs this much, which is obviously why it's been so well received.
Thank you.
That's okay. There's not many people that are doing it to that kind of standard without being a TV production. And even Petrolicious has kind of tailed off somewhat in their offerings, because that was the big draw for them, was this is so-and-so with his one-of-one Lamborghini from 1967. Yeah. This is the story, this is the emotion, here it is around some lovely Italian roads. Yeah. You're now in this world with them rather than just seeing what it is. And I think that's what you guys are really capturing so brilliantly, is the audience is with you on this story.
Yeah.
They're not just seeing what you've done. They're experiencing a lot of the trip, the scenery, the noise, that not necessarily the smell... Not there yet, but there's a lot
You can describe that as well. Yeah. It's something you always try and think about. Yeah, but you're absolutely right. And it was something, that sort of thing came from the writing side of it. You know, it's I've always maintained that the magazine side of things, and I said it before, but I thought magazines are sort of the print version of videos, because you've got the words and the photos working together, and you'd always think, right, what. When I'm describing everything through the words, you've got the visuals, but that's static. So, right, how do you bring the speed into your writing? How do you bring the, like I say, the smells, the sights, the sounds? You've got to bring all of that there. Some of that, now, obviously, in the video, it's a case of show, don't tell. Equally, smell is something like we can't. So you do have to sort of think, if there's a particular... smell, then it's nice, and it brings the audience into the, like say, into the film.
It includes the immersion aspect, doesn't it? Like, there's probably a large portion of your videos where you're like, I'm just going to be quiet now and let you listen to this car go through these hills.
Yeah.
Because we don't always need to be talking through a video.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously with a written article, there's no gaps. It's not like you can have a little bit of a, I'm going to leave you alone for 2 minutes and then see you at the next bit of the page.
Yeah.
But it's really, like, great to hear that that's how it was always meant to be as well. Like, it comes from a place of passion and design and almost like an emotional connection, and not, how do we get the most views? Oh, we'll tell a really nice story. That'll get lots of eyeballs on it. It's, right, how do we want to present what we do, and what do we want to attach our names to at the end of the day?
I think it's a... I think it's a case of, right, well, if that's what I want to see, then you hope that other people will want to see it too.
Yeah.
And
that's how I design t-shirts. That's the only reason that I make t-shirts and hoodies is, well, I'd probably wear these. I imagine someone else would like to. And if I'm going to design something, it might be something that I'm happy to wear.
Yeah.
Otherwise, exactly. What's the bloody point?
And I've been very lucky that, again, there was a brief hiatus with Drive Tribe.
Time that comes up in conversation with no matter who it is. So one of my friends used to be a writer on Drive Tribe, and other people that I've encountered have had dealing. It seems to be this weird little black hole that appears, and then it's like, well, that happened, and we'll keep moving.
But no, I was again when I was made redundant from there. Car faction came along, and Alex Goy, who obviously started at X-Car, he'd moved across to Motor One, and so they were sort of presenterless at the time, and I was lucky that they were. I knew Charlie was working there, who's the video producer, and again, it was like working with Sam. I knew straight away that Charlie had that sort of idea of this is what we want to make, and they had the budget to allow us to go and do it, which was fantastic. So yeah,
it's amazing, because I imagine with something like the content that you guys create, it has to have started with money to then get the right content to build that audience. Like, it's not like me and my iPhone wandering around hoping that I then get enough people interested that it will eventually lead to funding making better videos. It's got to have come with some backing to start with, and with this plan of, right, we need to make these videos to get X amount of views, to get X amount of subscribers, that leads to YouTube giving us X amount in ad revenue for it to then self-sustain.
Yes.
And I'm always bemused by how these things happen. It's like, who's having this conversation? Right, we're going to make a YouTube channel, and we're going to get all these followers, and then it's going to make us some money. And it's like, oh, that sounds like a sound investment. Let's do it. It must be such a... like a tense conversation at the start.
Yes, I think sort of when you look at the YouTube channels out there, the car ones, and most of them have probably come from a certain amount of backing to start with, or say born out of a they have to have some money, and generally there's other things going on as well other than just the YouTube channel for them. And it was Car Faction was great because it was CNET at the time. It was owned by CBS, then Viacom CBS when there was the merger, so that's the world's largest broadcasting corporation. And when you kind of bring it all the way back to Car Faction, you hope you're a pixel on the final decimal point of a spreadsheet that actually, although we in the car world, the films cost probably more money to make than a lot of them, although probably not as much as people would. Some people would think, if that makes sense, but
I think some people have the perception that you buy every car that's in the video. Like, these books cost millions. You're like, we give them back.
And a lot of it was done in done in a single day shoot or whatever, and we've been very lucky that the cameras and the equipment and stuff have improved so much. Certainly since Sam and I were first doing it, and the drones and things, and that if you have people that know how to use them, I wouldn't profess. I can understand, obviously, from having been around it, what shots we might be able to get and create. But the videographers, the likes of Glenn, who I do a lot of stuff with now, it's great because you can have these conversations, and they're so talented at getting the shots and making it look like television, frankly, a lot of the time.
It's incredible how accessible it's become, isn't it? Liam and Jared from the Backroads TM, and they've now got a trademark, so I have to say that, otherwise they'll have a moan at me. That's two guys that do it on their weekends every so often. They wrote me into it to strap myself to the back of a car and hold a camera and stuff like that. But the quality, and it's real credit to Liam's editing ability.
Yeah.
The quality is so high that you wouldn't think it was two guys, a couple of grand's worth of cameras that they've had for 5 years, and some mates hanging out the back of an E46 touring. You'd think it had been done, properly, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then if you take that and kind of keep going up that scale to where you guys are, it's no wonder that it looks like it's such a super high production, which obviously it is, but it's not a 6 Range Rovers and a TV crew. It's a much smaller team than you'd expect when you actually do meet the team. You're like, oh, there's only 4 of you.
Like, and most are just two of us.
It's like you and one guy with a camera out in Wales or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's really inspiring, especially for anyone that has hopes of getting into the industry in some regard, that it is now getting more accessible if you are willing to put the time and the effort into utilize the tools to their full capacity. You can make good high level quality content, and you don't necessarily need big funding to do so. You need to have a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of dedication, and hopefully enough drive to get the ball rolling towards the bigger opportunities. Like, I know their guys, or those guys, kind of goal is to hopefully get towards some form of sponsorship to help improve the content they can create.
Yeah.
Because you hit the barrier of, well, I've only got two cars, or I've only got one car, and I've done everything to it, and I've driven it everywhere. What do I do now?
Yeah.
And fortunately, they've got some friends that have different cars, so I get involved, and Mike, who runs the cafe that we do coffees and cars, he's now getting involved, and you start to make friends in different circles, and you come up with new ideas. But for anyone that's aspiring to get into the automotive world in that kind of fashion, it's so much more accessible these days.
Yeah. Oh, it's phones.
Yeah.
So many people have
My phone will shoot 4K 60 frames per second.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
That's it's more technologically advanced than half the stuff from 15 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when we started, we were still putting the tapes in the side of the cameras and and doing all that. And
now that's just a filter kind of, on Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah, this is it. You know, it's extraordinary what you can produce with a phone.
It's mad. Like, so I do, just as a more of a this is what it's like to be within the car world kind of thing, whenever I go to shows and events, I'll do like little walk arounds and try and get some element of creativity into it. And I've not been able to do them for the last 3 months. I've done the videos, I just haven't been able to spend the time to, because it's just me. And I've had a couple of people go, when's the next one coming out? It's really nice to just see what you're like, to be at an event that I couldn't go to, or to go to a show, or it's nice for people to see those things.
Yeah.
And it adds a real like satisfaction, like, oh, I should probably put more effort into that. If people actually enjoy what you do.
Mm.
So I imagine for you, when you've got the likes of me going, that was a really good video, and then 8 million other people going, there's a really good video. You're like, right, I've got to do well on the next one, otherwise they're going to be so disappointed.
Yeah, yeah, there's definitely an element of having created a rod for your own back with...
just keep setting that bar higher and higher.
And it's, which is good in some ways, because you don't want to stagnation. You keep pushing yourself to do better. We have to sometimes recognise when you're not going to be able to hit the absolute highs that you'd really want to, or sort of accept, right, this video is going to be shorter, or it's not going to be as, you know, beautifully crafted as we might want, and yeah, I've probably got a bit better at going with the flow on that sort of thing, but yeah, other times it just doesn't work, and you feel like you're sitting there desperately trying to come up with the idea, or the sort of the what are you going to do this time to make it interesting or different.
There's a few of my t-shirts of the month that have come from those moments. I'm like, oh crap, this needs to happen. Like, pull a bloody idea out of your head and crack on with it.
Yeah.
But I imagine you find kind of more than you'd expect, that you actually come up with something more outside the box than you'd have originally done in those moments.
Yes, I think I enjoy the launch is the classic example. You get flown somewhere different, which is great because you've instantly got a different location to go at, and there'll be things you haven't seen before, so as long as you keep your eyes open, then there'll be something that you can riff off, as it were, but you do have to think on your feet, and
it's all improvised really, isn't it?
A lot of it.
It's almost like the bag's been pulled off your head, go, you're like, oh
yeah,
crap.
Yeah, and you can come up with an idea beforehand, which will sort of, you think, okay, right, well, this can we try and do that, and you look at Google Maps or the hotel or whatever, a lot of the time you have to don't ever get too wedded to that kernel of an idea that you've had, because a bit like the sort of, you know, not prejudging the car, if you can end up trying to force something which is just not going to work. So whereas you've got a lovely view over there, actually let's just make that, and if we do this shot, then suddenly, and I can put a line of voice over it afterwards, which suddenly makes people go, oh, this is kind of,
oh, that's amazing. Great.
Well, that's kind of, yeah, exactly. Rather than, you know, sweating for an hour to get this shot that doesn't really work anyway, and people go, oh, well, it's kind of, I sort of see what he's getting. So yeah, you have to think on your feet, which I love. It's quite stressful, and it's certainly...
But I imagine that's probably the exciting... I know driving nice cars quickly is quite exciting, but in terms of a professional sense, that's probably the excitement rush that you get when that all comes together and the stakes are high, but the payoff is high kind of thing.
Yes, yeah, it's very much... I have always loved the writing and the creative side of the job. I got into it because I love cars and you love reading about cars and you like the cars are the thing. But I think probably the longer my career has gone on, the even more satisfaction I've got from coming out of it with content that I feel proud of. And it sort of feels weird to go somewhere now and actually almost just enjoy a car and not feel like I've got to come back with something. I've got to write it for this or do it. And actually, sometimes you have to just think.
Just be a car enthusiast for a bit.
Exactly, just enjoy it. Which
it's interesting. Like, so I get a certain bit of that. Obviously, I've not been doing the car world stuff for very long. So I'm still, everything is new and exciting. There's a certain amount of... Because I run meets and because I go to events to trade, if I go to a car show just to be around cars, there's a certain amount of, it's quite nice to be present, not have to have any thinking around, who do I need to speak to here, or how many T-shirts do I have to sell to cover the cost of being here, or what person have I got to kind of make sure they're okay while they're... Just to, this is actually why I enjoy cars. It's quite a nice thing. But I imagine you have those opportunities less so because of who you are. Being at those events often inherently comes with people going, oh my God, you're that guy. And then you're like, I've got to have my question ready all the time.
No, I don't sort of, I don't, or like, and thankfully I'm not recognised that much. So I can still...
You can still sneak into a car show.
Exactly. I can.
Because I've been with Alex Goy at, say, Caffeine and Machine, for example. And he kind of has to be Alex Goy all the time.
Yeah.
There's not very many opportunities for him to kind of not be the Alex Goy that people expect. And I've always found it interesting to be around him or anybody that's quite well known. So, for example, Harry Metcalf at Bicester. That even though it's their passion, not your passion, there's still an amount of expectation that you kind of... It's not a disingenuousness, but there's a kind of, you've got a certain amount of barrier or guard ready for being approached or ready for having a stranger come up to you that you don't know, but they know you.
Yeah.
And I imagine that's probably one of the challenging parts that people don't realise comes with being kind of known.
Yeah, I suppose it's, I think it's, I suppose I know it's going to happen now, and it doesn't really bother me that much, so I can sort of,
you can,
I am who I am. I'm not somebody that different on camera. I mumble a lot more, as you can probably hear on the podcast, than I do on camera. At least I can edit that out to make
this doesn't get edited
more,
by the way,
more professional now. It's fine.
Threw Alex a curveball by doing it on Zoom, telling him that the video was going up and he was in a Star Wars Wookiee dressing gown.
Excellent.
He's like, what? You didn't tell me that. I was like, it's all right, it won't go. It's fine. I've still got the video. I might sneak it out one day.
Should do it. But yeah, I am who I am, and that's it. So I suppose, yeah, it's going back to the whole the just enjoying the cars and the sort of the being present and things like that. It's those moments are the ones that kind of probably happen off camera. It's ironically, they're the moments you're trying to create for camera. I'm just going to cough. Thing, sorry.
So one sip of the Northampton water.
Exactly.
I've been through a Brita filter. Oh. Everything.
That's hay fever for you.
Don't mean to turn the fan off, because that would be blowing from outside.
It's fine. It's all good. But yeah, the moments that... Yes, when I particularly remember there was a film we did on Mallorca, and we're sitting there, and it's the end of a day. We had a long drive to do and stuff like that, but there's a time lapse going on. And you're sitting there with Dean who was doing the first show, Sam who's doing the filming. And you're just sitting there and there's a car and there's a sunset, and there's nothing else to do other than think, this is amazing. Yeah. It's absolutely sort of, you know, here we are, we're all friends as well as, you know, work colleagues. Mm. But isn't this, how cool is it? You know,
this is the sunset. Dream.
This is almost, just the dream, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And by that point, because a lot of what we do, you know, we try to get to the roads early in the morning or late in the evening or stay late in the day to get the best light, and that's the thing when generally everybody else has gone home, so you've got these amazing places effectively to yourself.
Mm.
And then you've got the drive, it's been said plenty of times before, but the sort of, you know, the Evo car of the year or the car faction shoot that, you know, you're driving back to the hotel when you, all the cameras have been turned off, and that's the drive that
you enjoy,
is really lodged in my
brain.
And that's, so you do get to experience.
I imagine that must have peaked when you did the F1 GT1 AMG GTR, whichever variant of that, the CLK GTR?
CLK GTR, yes.
Trio. I imagine those drives back to the hotel or back to give the car to whoever.
Yeah, I mean, that was all done at Millbrook, so that was, I didn't really get those.
Was none of that out on public roads then?
No.
Because from, I think it was the Porsche, there was a bit that seemed like it was like a country lane in the Welsh countryside.
Mm.
You're like, it's a bit damp and it's a bit screwy. I was like, what an absolute legend for like not going, right, we're not doing that. I'm not writing this thing off in the rain.
Yeah, that was, it was quite a stressful day at Millbrook on the hill route, which is...
I've never been to Millbrook. So
It was the hill route, which is great because it can
what you want it to
mimic
it
a
got me.
Country road. So as it, hence them using it in various films, including Bond film Casino Royale, where he rolled the...
Yeah, which is an annoying scene because no Aston Martin's going to roll that many times on its own.
That was quite a shoot. And again, a lot of pressure to... Not a lot of time in the car, so you've really got to think.
Yeah.
You know, you've got three laps of the hill route to do your pieces to camera and know exactly what you're going to... Not exactly what you're going to say, but just have at least a few facts you can hinge it off, and then just be very aware of everything that the car's telling you and try and communicate exactly what's going on, say what it's like.
That's a high-stakes video, isn't it? Because those opportunities don't come around.
No. You want to get that right. It's one of those things, and you know that you've got to make it happen. However difficult it is in terms of all time constraints.
Yeah,
it is actually. No, and there was a moment actually. The sort of, I suppose the moment in that of the drive back to the hotel was we did some tracking shots at the end of the day actually for a photographer, and I'd done my piece of the camera. There was nothing more I could do at that point. It wasn't for
the
film that we were driving. I was just in the car and I wasn't doing anything particularly amazing. But we had this tracking shot with the sunset and all three cars together, and I was in the GT1. And you know, to be able to look out of that little side window and see the CLK GTR and then the F1 up ahead, that's, you know,
that's the stuff that dreams are made of.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. You just that is the sort of thing that, you know, you go back to those, you know, work experience.
I hope you've got
days
one of those tracking shots framed somewhere for
future reference. I haven't at the moment, but I do have those photos that I will. Yeah, I'll get it done at some point. But it's
like, just to have that experience is going to be one of those like that just sticks for a long time, even though the videos exist and the photos. It's the, again, that connected to it, the emotion, the feeling, the stuff that you can't recreate through any sort of like media. That's the real kind of piece that you'll take away, really.
Yeah, yeah. It's, but I think I feel so lucky that I get to create something out of it, and I think that's the sort of, you know, and something that does reflect a lot of that pinch yourself stuff, and which is what you're just trying to get across to other people. It's sort of it's the
you very much bring that come with me, we're getting this experience. It's not aren't I lucky I got to do this. It's we're going to be part of this once in a lifetime chance to have these three cars together that won't likely happen again. and it comes across in the films that it's not a... Henry Catchpole was a very lucky man. It's a, right, let's go on this journey, come along for the ride.
But I am, yeah.
You are a very lucky man.
I'm a very lucky man, but I'm not... I don't own
but that's not
all
the messaging.
These cars. And, no, exactly. And it's... I think, if anything, sometimes there's a... I've seen it sort of occasionally. There's nothing worse than being told that you're sort of... you know, you're having your integrity questioned, or you never said anything bad about cars, but the cars that I get to drive, I'm not really driving the cars.
We'll take my Renault out, it's okay.
Yeah, it's all right, I drive mine. I got plenty wrong with it, but it's I'm driving things that are fundamentally pretty fun. I can obviously still remain objective, and I hope I do, in terms of saying, this is good, this is bad, this is, you know, I can't drive an Aventador Ultima and not say that the gearbox is pretty terrible in automotive, frankly. It's not a good gearbox. I don't care. Sort of, yes, you can call it character and you can work around it, but fundamentally, in this day and age of DCT,
yeah,
it's not great. There's, you know, like Lotus Emira, it is not perfect. There's that gearbox and engine don't really live up to the looks of the rest of the car,
right,
particularly, but equally they're not that bad, and yeah, it's, and I don't ever want to, it would be all too easy to sort of forget that person that walked into Evo as a 22 year old who'd only really driven a Mini before and you know, just was so happy to see and sit in one of those cars, let alone drive one.
Yeah.
And you've, I think it's sort of, you know,
you become spoiled.
There's enough else bad going on in the world that,
yeah,
you know, being really negative about something just for the sake of it, or really, you know, having, yeah, if
I've got to find a bad thing.
Exactly,
about it,
yeah. Yeah. And so, yes, oh, of course I'll say if something's bad, but again, people, I'm not an overly sort of, I suppose, negative person
Well, it's not like you're looking for faults, though, is it? You're trying to just give
feedback, and you know, and there will be things, certainly handling traits and stuff that I don't like or doesn't do it for me. But then I'll get more and more picky as the years go by because I get to drive so many things, so I know exactly what I like in a car.
Yeah.
But that doesn't
like
mean that
GT4 RS video where you were like, yeah, this is the best thing in the world.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I was having and that's the thing, you've got to trust it. Am I having a well of a time? Yes, I am. Right. Well, you know,
I'm going to say that.
Yeah, and I don't. People say, oh, he's a Porsche lover, so he's going to sort of, he must be being paid by Porsche or something. They just make brilliant cars. So
there's a reason they're so popular.
Yeah, and you know, but then when the Taycan came out and I drove that, and it really wasn't, you know, it just didn't really do it for me. I've subsequently driven other ones, and they're getting better and better because Porsche do that thing of it's an iterative process, and they're very good at knowing that things have got to improve, and there'll be software updates and things get better. And I had a brief go in a Taycan GTS the other day, and that's, I have to do a video on it at some point, because you really do start to think, hang on a minute, for the first time, I'm driving an EV thinking, yeah, there's something in this.
That's promising to hear.
Which is great, but, you know, and again, I can't base all my perspective on the Taycan purely off that first drive, because, again, you think, right, well, has it changed? Yes, it has. It's not the same as it was before. So, right, what have they done, and why am I enjoying this more? Right, the steering feels so much better.
Because one of the big things for the Taycan was the 911 steering rack, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was we've put a Porsche steering system in it to make it feel more like a Porsche. And to hear that they've continued to progress down that line it's very Porsche, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
We started with a thing, we think it's a good idea, we'll keep going until we've got it right.
Yeah.
And that's what you want.
Equally, 718 Cayman, yeah, that four-cylinder engine.
Mm.
Not good. And it just...
I wanted the 981. With the 6-speed manual, and I test drove one. Not that I can afford one, but I'll give one a go. And I didn't like it. And then I went in my friend's, who has the sports seats and the sports exhaust, and it was like a completely different car.
Yeah.
I was like, why didn't the one that I went in? I'd have ended up making a huge financial mistake if I'd driven this one. Yeah. But again, it's one of those, hopefully Porsche developing a bit more with the 718 to make it better.
Yeah, yeah.
I was always worried about the four-cylinder in that.
Yeah, it just wasn't a particularly...
Although they put a bloody 3-litre four-cylinder in the 944, so there's always some scope for different stuff, which Liam from the Backroads has, and I mock him relentlessly, calling it a Scirocco, even though I bloody love the thing. I put Scirocco stickers on it once, because I've got, behind you is some stickers that I made today, so I've got a sticker machine, and it was at, a friend of ours has a, they have a recovery company, but they've got a big workshop and a load of storage space, so it spent a lot of time there. And the Renault's just come back from there. So every time I go over, I put stickers on different cars. So our friend has, I think he's on XJS number like 12 or something like that. He's just renowned for all these Jaguars. So there's this in-joke that he hell crate swaps them. He doesn't. He hates that. He loves V12 manuals. But we've got this joke that his nickname is Mr. Hell Crate. So one day when I did the wrap, it's not a wrap, it's individual bits of vinyl, but for the sake of purposes, I was there for 2 days, locked in their warehouse, effectively, with my vinyl cutter. And I was like, well, I'm not going to get this opportunity again. So I went around and put a Mr. Hellcrate sticker on every Jaguar I could find. And then I was like, oh, the 944's here. So then I made some Scirocco badges and put it all over that as well. And because it was parked next to a wall, it took him 3 weeks to find one of them.
Brilliant.
And our Jared, who's the other half of the Backroads, TM, he'll listen to this. He knew that he hadn't found that one, so he recorded it when he finally found it, and it was the sweetest little video. Excellent. But that's the car world, in that you can have these friends, you can have that fun, and I imagine a lot of the stuff that you do really does bring you a lot of connection with other people, and a lot of community comes around all the stuff that you guys get up to.
Yeah, I mean, your story reminds me of drove a Mustang GT350.
In the one with the flat pane days,
that's
crank.
The one, yeah, lovely. Absolutely. And it was across in the States, and Aston Parrott, Evo's photographer, was, for some reason, he had to pick it up somewhere in Southern California and drove it up to meet me. So I'd got a hire car because it was off the back of a... Sorry, I'm making this story far more complicated.
Keep going, it's fine.
The point is, we did the shoot, everything like that, said goodbye, and I got in this little Hyundai that, you know, couldn't pull the skin off a rice pudding, and headed down. I was going down to Specialized, the bike company, actually, to go and say hi to somebody down there. Drove down there, he disappeared off to take the car back, and I Specialized, said hi to them, had a wander around, going that, drove off somewhere else. Anyway, it was quite a long time before I realised what he had drawn in the dusty side of the hire car. And I won't say what it was, but I'm sure you can imagine the inappropriate nature of...
So you're riding around with that.
Yeah, exactly.
Going
yeah,
and seeing
yeah,
the guy.
Exactly,
special.
Yeah. Sort of, why are these people hooting him? It's only a little Hyundai. Perhaps I've been recognised as Henry Catchpole. Perhaps I've broken America. No. There is Malphalos on the side of the car in the dust. So great. Thank you very much for that.
But that's the point about having friends, though, isn't
exactly,
it?
Yes.
If he was scared
was
to
short,
do that.
It was a short text message I sent him.
Yeah. I imagine it started with you and ended with what the description of that drawing was.
Yes.
That's the whole car world for me. And to kind of bring it to how we connected, because it's a nice thing. I like telling people it, so I'm going to say it to your face. You bought one of my T-shirts... And people will go, oh, it's nice when they get for you. No, Henry bought one of my T-shirts without telling me, without me knowing who you were. Like, without me, you knowing who I... Like, as a stranger, we'd never met or spoken or anything like that. I knew who you were. I wasn't expecting that name to pop up on an order. Mm-hmm. And it was when I'd first started. So the T-shirts I was making when I first started, I'm very much a let's have a go and figure it out kind of person. Mm-hmm. And this whole ability to make T-shirts started off the back of that. In a customer of mine, when I worked for UPS, had a sublimation printer and could do one-off, like one at a time, cheap T-shirts. And they cost about £8 to make and about £3 to post. Mm. And they did the job of being a T-shirt, but they weren't very good T-shirts. They were high polyester count, because that's how you sublimate is with polyester. You can't do it to cotton. It doesn't work. And they were quite thin. They were cheap T-shirts, basically. But you still, you bought one, and it went to you, and you didn't say anything, and you didn't send it back. And it
and
meant
I still
a lot.
Have it, and I still wear it.
And so. You sent me a photo of you wearing it, and it meant a lot. And then my ability to create the T-shirts improved through a new supplier and ultimately using screen printing, which is a much more high-quality process. So I sent you another one to say thank you. Here's the T-shirt that you should have had all along. But the real thing was that it meant so much as someone just starting to try and do something, to have someone that I look up to as a professional in the industry with quite arguably a reasonable amount of credibility, to receive that almost like commendation of, oh, I like what you're doing. It meant a lot. And then when I sent you a proper one and you didn't go, well, these haven't changed at all.
No, I'm not going to lie. The one that you sent
the black
me,
and gold one
kind,
is,
black and gold one is really lovely. It's a really nice quality.
It's got t-shirt. Better if you put them side by side.
Yes, yeah.
And then on top of that, to then wear that black and gold one in the Carfection video, that meant a lot as well. And I got a couple of sales out of that. That was nice. Oh, it was a good week. My website traffic, because my feature on my episode of the Driven Chat podcast, mm-hmm. and that video came out in the same couple of days, my website traffic has never got that high again. I had 1 week where it was really high because of those two things, and I've been chasing that dragon ever since. But it really meant a lot. And the other thing that happened was when you had a look at that thing that I wrote, that meant a lot, because you are a professional in the industry that spends all of his time either writing or creating videos, and to spend 5 minutes just reading through a stranger's piece of work, it means a lot, and it's a real show of character. And the fact that you're here is another show of character, because you have, when you got here, you're like, I've got a phone call with bloody like a supercar manufacturer. I might have to take that at some point. It's a testament to how busy you are all the time.
It doesn't happen all the time. It was just
I've had an hour and a half of your time without a phone call from a supercar manufacturer. It's the only hour and a half that will happen. He's lying, I promise. But it means a lot as someone that is A, new into the game, B, has no experience and is trying to figure it out as they go along. And to have someone that is kind of one of those people where I have, like, that's what I would like to do. I mean, I'm not following it as much as I probably should, but the intention will be there once the dust has settled from what's happening at the minute. It just means a lot, and I think it's worth saying thank you for that.
Oh, that's it.
Because you don't have to, but you still do.
Well, delighted to have helped in any way I can.
No, so I appreciate it. And it's inspiring for other people that may be passionate about cars and wouldn't know how to step into the industry. Because the way into the industry now is not what it was before.
No, it's not.
You don't do, can I come and do work experience? Well, you might be able to.
I think it's still worth trying. I think it's in some ways, though, it's easier than it was.
There's a real sense of that, because everyone's a lot more interconnected.
There's a lot more competition out there.
That's the flip side of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it would be much harder for me to approach, say, Evo as a relatively unheard of person, very relatively unheard of, I've not been heard of, and go, I write, would you like to pay me to write for you? When next door can go, I write, I'll do it for free for the passion. There's a lot of kind of creating your own value and stuff like that, and then there's also a lot of, well, you can do things yourself if you can build an audience. So that it's a really dynamic world to be in any way a part of. And I imagine for you, it's probably, you're well established enough that you don't quite have the same worries that someone who's never done it before would have, but at the same time you're probably kind of like, right, who's coming after me, who's trying to get
absolutely, it's my, you know, this is my career now. I've kind of got to keep it, try and keep it going. And back to the question of sort of, you know, making a rod for your own back, but you do want to keep improving and doing the best job that that you can, and yeah, it's
well, it's even more of a testament to you as being a nice person that your career depends on you writing for people and like creating content, yeah, and things like that, and then you get someone like me go, would you look at this piece of work? And rather than going, I see you now as potential future competition, you go, here's how to get better at trying to take my job in the future.
Well,
not that I am in any way trying to hunt down your position either. I've had one article and that's it. I've got my foot. No, it's an interesting world to see behind the curtain of,
yeah,
and to find out that a vast majority of the people that are involved are nice people is really reassuring. Yeah, and it offers, if I can in some way get involved in it, and I haven't had a history of being in the car world, and I fell out of love with the car world for a few years when I didn't have an interest in car, it hopefully offers some sort of inspiration for other people that if you have the right attitude and you put your mind to it, you can probably find a way in some way.
Yeah.
And if I've found a way in one way, someone will find a way in a different way.
Yeah.
And then we'll all be Henry Catchpole.
Good grief. Horrendous world that would
be. No, you're far too tall for me to chase after. So what can we expect in the future for you, Mr. Catchpole? Obviously, you're doing stuff with the Intercooler guys.
Yes. Yep.
Which is a fun, exciting thing.
Yes, enjoying doing that. Enjoying doing some sort of more regular writing for them, because it's nice to keep my hand in with that, and it's a bit more...
Are they shorter pieces?
Yeah, they tend to be between sort of 800 to 1200 words is roughly what they want from me.
Because they are fully digital media, aren't they?
They are.
They are the iPad from 15 years ago.
Exactly, now. Yeah. But having said that, obviously I still get to write the long form stuff for Evo occasionally, but the bulk of my time is taken up with with Carfection, just because the videos are... generally
take time to make them,
take time to make, and that sort of thing, but so
those are the three main things that we can be expecting for the future, for the foreseeable anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I'd like to do a bit more cycling stuff again, but that's kind of taken a bit of a back seat at the moment. So yeah, I've got various thoughts, always trying to think what's next, where can we take it next, what's bigger and better, and you know, doing, I'd love to one day try and do something for, you know, a Netflix series or something like that, sort of see what there is out there.
That could be something fun.
Yeah, could be. That's a whole other world to try and understand and
then find an appropriate way into, and exactly, get the right pitches and meet with the right people.
Yeah, it's a bit like a sort of, I'd love to write a book one of these days, sort of.
Well, if anyone's got the skill set...
No, no.
See, it's a 20,000 word article rather than a 3,000 word.
It's yes, it would be nice to do, and I think if I could give myself a little bit more time to do that, then it'll happen, I'm sure, at some point.
I think the thing to take away from that is, no matter who you are, you're always chasing a project that you haven't dedicated time or energy to. Like, I'm always like, I should probably sit down and write some stuff, because the guys at the Backroads TM very kindly said, would you, if you wanted to, we'll help put some stuff on the internet, on their site and stuff like that. So yeah, that's great. And then like, the next week rolls around, like, I should probably have written something by now. And then if it's not me, I want to write a book. And I should probably dedicate some time. Yeah. And I imagine that everybody in every industry, no matter who they are and no matter who you look up to, they're having the same things. I should probably do that at some point.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you're making videos, writing for Evo and writing for the Intercooler, and you're still like, I should really have more time. This dude works three jobs, effectively. But it's been an absolute pleasure, and I have taken up a fair amount of your afternoon.
Not at all. It's been lovely. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
No, I appreciate it.
It's nice to have a chat.
Yes, and hopefully this is a nice example for people that conversations aren't, like, daunting. It would be very easy to find conversation, and it's not to say that they aren't, and it's not to say that there isn't stress around talking to people and to devalue the things such as like anxiety and stuff like that. But hopefully these podcasts act as an example that pretty much everybody that you meet, regardless of who they are, is a person,
Yeah. And it's that sort of, I should say this because it's obviously what I do. We said it before, I try to make everything look, polished, I suppose. And it's, and the version of things that you want to project to people, because it's, you're making a video you want people to enjoy and that sort of thing. Yeah. But equally, it's easy to assume that it's all plain sailing and all that, and it's sort of it's not, which kind of makes it hopefully more human and enjoyable in some space. Yeah. If you do have that in mind, that you sort of, you can almost sort of wonder what on earth they had to do to get that, and sort of it's sitting there in the random hotel trying to brew yourself some coffee first thing in the morning because you're not gonna, and it's all fun, but it's not. You get the I get the anxieties as well, like we said. It was sort of, right, what am I, you're sitting there, what am I going to do for this one? How do we make it work? And, the camera's gone wrong, the car's broken down, or, not going to get home in time. You said you were going to get home. Or it's just all those things, they're all there.
Yeah.
And I don't post a lot on social media and sort of Instagram and stuff. And so you only get the kind of the
things that you are.
I just don't share a great deal of stuff, but that's not to kind of, so it would be very easy to assume that my life is perfect.
you texted me earlier saying I'm going to be late because things are going chaotically in the wrong direction for this thing I'm supposed to be doing tomorrow. Yeah. Like, these things happen, and they are, that is part and parcel with life, isn't it?
Yeah,
no matter exactly who you are and what you're doing,
yeah,
these things happen.
Yeah,
but it's that, let's keep going, let's try and make the best of it, let's
Learn
when to say, right, we need to push this back or postpone to another time, this isn't the right moment, we'll cost ourselves more than we'll benefit if we do it that way.
And it's the people thing again, isn't it? That coming back to the, I can, when it's all going a bit wrong, the ability to be able to turn to somebody else, or the most important thing is to be able to turn to somebody else and say, pick up the phone and say, this is happening.
Yeah.
Can I just run it by you? Whether I think they've got the answer or not, or they can say yes or no, or whether it's the videography and say, should we just give up on this one, this shot, or let's not bother, or calm them down and no. But it's the talking it through is, and I'm not very good at doing it, but I try. Remember,
I'm not very good at doing it, and I have It's Okay to Talk written over almost everything I own, and my partner's a psychologist, and I'm still the,
it's not easy.
Just bottle it up and soldier on, and we'll figure it out as we go along.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's the real takeaway is that it isn't easy. These things do happen. Everybody is a person that has to deal with it all, but it's that kind of perseverance and that kind of self-awareness that keeps things going.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we'll all just sit around and do nothing because it's all too hard and it's all too scary.
Exactly.
And bravery comes from facing fear. Everybody is scared.
Yeah.
But real bravery is being scared and keeping going. And it's not that I don't get scared. Everybody gets scared. Yeah. If they say they don't, they're lying to you, or they have a problem that's not been diagnosed properly. Mm. But thank you again for coming on. Thank you for sitting and chatting. And I'm sorry if I've caused you some more hay fever by having the door open.
No, not at all.
hopefully the fan hasn't been hit like
all the time. There's only one cough, it's fine. Just one cough. It's not a problem with the throat, it's all good.
But no, thank you very much. And the best place to find you for the few things you do post is just Henry Catchpole.
Probably Instagram's the best place. So at Henry Catchpole, nice and easy.
Perfect.
On Instagram.
And if not that, it's Carfection have their own.
Definitely Carfection, yes.
Create a lot of amazing content. So thank you again, and I'll end it there.